Well, hello and welcome everybody to ICMDA webinars. I'm Dr. Peter Saunders, the Chief Executive of the International Christian Medical and Dental Association, which brings together over 80 national groups of Christian doctors and dentists around the world. And today is a bit of a milestone because this is our 50th webinar since starting in the early months of COVID last year. And we're honored today to have with us Sharon James to speak on the subject of how Christianity transformed healthcare, and it really did. This will be a great eye-opener for people today. Let me introduce Sharon James. Sharon studied history at Cambridge University. She has an MDiv from Toronto Baptist Seminary and a doctorate from the University of Wales. She's married to Bill, who is principal of London Seminary. So very strong theological credentials in the family. They've got two grown-up children and four grandchildren, and Sharon works as social policy analyst for the Christian Institute in the UK. She's traveled to many countries as a conference speaker and is the author of several books, most recently Gender Ideology, What Do Christians Need to Know? And there's a new book just out that I'm sure she'll tell you about on the broader subject that we're looking at today. So that title of Gender Ideology is available in Spanish and currently being translated into a number of other languages as well. So it's my pleasure to introduce Sharon James to speak to us on how Christianity transformed healthcare. Thank you, Sharon.
Well, once again, thank you very much, Peter, for the invitation to join you. And I want to pay tribute to the way that God has used you over many years in the defense of biblical ethics surrounding healthcare, particularly issues around the protection of human life. And of course, I want to pay tribute to the work that all of you are doing, all of you who've joined the seminar. I'm really excited by this international ministry. And I want to thank you for all you do. Over many years, I've seen firsthand some incredible service in terms of medical care, dental care, general care for both my family, friends, the people who Bill and I have pastored over the years. And in several different countries, I've seen firsthand examples of extraordinary expertise and compassion offered by both Christians and non-Christians. But of course, whenever we see those good things, we give God the glory, because we know that whether people acknowledge it or not, those instincts to care and to serve and to heal come from God himself. Now, I'm not a medic or a dentist, and I have no particular specialist expertise in this area. But when I was investigating my latest book, How Christianity Transformed the World, I really wanted to include a chapter on the extraordinary contribution that Christians have made towards the development of healthcare across the world. And of course, I was only able to hit a few of the highlights, but I was able to offer signposts to more detailed resources. And there is or will be a resource list placed up on the website if you want to investigate further. Now, when God created the world, of course, it was a perfect world and there was no sickness, no pain, no suffering, and no death. But that all changed with the rebellion of our first parents. We now live in a world that is marred by sickness and pain and death. But even in this fallen world, we have all been created in the image of God. And that means that we all have capacity to love, to care, to study, to reason, and in different ways to ameliorate the results of the fall. And God blesses all people, doesn't he? Jesus told us that God causes his sun to shine, his rain to fall on both the just and the unjust. And we sometimes call that God's common grace or his everyday grace, as distinct from his saving grace. But because God has created all human beings in his image with that capacity to care, with a conscience, with the capacity to reason, we do find a measure of medical advance in every civilization. Notably, those who followed in the tradition of the Greek doctor Hippocrates of Kos famously promised that they would first do no harm, that they would not procure abortions, that they would respect patient confidentiality and they would protect their patients from any exploitation. And of course, Greek, Roman, Islamic civilizations all produced great physicians and surgeons, but none of them produced an ethic of care where there was the absolute obligation to care for every single human being without exception. That ethic would develop out of the biblical worldview. Because our God is the giver of life and the God of compassion. Genesis 1:27 explains that when he created human beings, he created us absolutely distinct from all the rest of creation. We alone bear God's image. And supremely, Christians affirm the dignity of human life because our Lord Jesus Christ himself became human. And he was incarnate from the moment of conception. So, God, the giver of life, demands that life should be protected from conception right through to natural death. And he demands that we should give dignity to all humans, not preferring some because of their so-called superior status. The whole Bible teaches that God is a God of mercy and compassion, and he teaches that if we truly follow him, we will have mercy and compassion as well. And the New Testament teaches very bluntly that if we say we have faith but have no works, our faith is dead. And today, whether or not we were brought up in Christian homes ourselves, probably many of us grew up in a culture that has been impacted by that Christian worldview that expects compassion and care to be shown to the weak and to the vulnerable and to the sick. And we take for granted that compassion is a good thing. But that was a radical idea. It wasn't the case in the pagan world at all. Some people have said that indeed the parable of the Good Samaritan is the parable that changed history. And that's recorded in three of the gospel accounts. And of course, one of the authors of one of those gospel accounts was Luke, himself a physician. Now, before we get into the historical record, I just want to paint a little vignette and give one small example of a grassroots Christian initiative that epitomizes the call of Jesus to love and care for all without distinction. It could be replicated countless times across the globe, wherever you find true followers of Jesus. So 17 years ago in San Jose, Costa Rica, a local church-based group began working with people with disabilities and their families. And that ministry was based on the core conviction of the dignity of all people as created by God, the importance of families, and love for those who are particularly suffering because of disabilities. And what began as a very simple group meeting has blossomed out into a wide-ranging ministry that provides a lifeline for many families, both practical and spiritual. Now, sadly, among that community, there have been many early deaths due to disabilities. But at those times of crisis, these families pull together to support one another in a remarkable way. And that ministry is carried out by Christian volunteers, not professionals. And it's a model of loving inclusion and support that's been picked up and imitated by many other local church communities. And the person who pioneered that ministry, Brenda Dark, has conducted training across Latin America in how to include and support people with disabilities and their families. And her handbook on the subject has been published in both Spanish and Portuguese, and it's on the resource list. Wherever you find God's true people, you find them engaged in a creative range of ministries and supports to those who are sick, disadvantaged, disabled, frail, and elderly. But we turn now to the historical record. Christianity spread very rapidly in the early centuries. It's possible that there were no more than a few thousand Christians in AD 40. But by the year AD 350, the sociologist Rodney Stark estimates that there could even have been 33 million Christians out of a total population in the empire of around 60 million. And he argues that one of the major factors in that extraordinary growth was the Christian ethic of protection of life and care and compassion. So famously, believers would risk their lives during plague years to care for those who were needy and sick and suffering, whereas sometimes pagans even abandoned their own families to flee for safety. Abortion was widely practiced in Greco-Roman society, and it not only destroyed the life of the unborn child, it was very dangerous for the mother as well. Christians opposed it, but they also rescued mothers and children and provided for them wherever they could. And that ethic of care saved countless lives. Infanticide also was widely practiced in Greco-Roman society. It was approved by the philosophers, particularly if infants were weak, disabled, sick, or female. The early Christians opposed infanticide, rescued infants whenever they could, and eventually Christian pressure prompted the Emperor Valentinian to outlaw the practice in AD 374. What about the foundation of the first hospitals? We know that both Old and New Testament insist that those who love God are to love neighbour as themselves. And we also know that Christians all over the world often recite the Nicene Creed, that foundational creed that affirms that our Lord Jesus Christ is both truly God and truly man. What's often forgotten, however, is that that same great Council of Nicaea in AD 325 commanded that in every place where there was a Christian cathedral, a Christian hospital should also be built. And the word hospital actually comes from the Latin word hospes, which means guests. As Professor John Wyatt helpfully points out, a hospital is a place where we practice hospitality, neighbour love to strangers, a bizarre concept introduced by one Jesus of Nazareth. Christian hospitals for the destitute and dying were founded by the reign of Constantine and would eventually be found right from the Syrian and Byzantine East to the western fringes of Christendom. Before that, it seems that the only hospitals really had been the institutions used by the Roman armies to restore their troops to fighting capacity. Basil of Caesarea was a rich man who famously left his family wealth and his legal career to embrace a monastic lifestyle. And he saw philanthropia, that is act of love for humankind, as an essential Christian virtue. As Bishop of Caesarea, Basil founded hospitals, orphanages, hostels for the poor, and he himself provided hands-on care. He also mobilized Christians to help women with unwanted pregnancies, and he also organized public protests against the Guild of Abortionists, who horrifically were selling the bodies of aborted babies to the manufacturers of beauty creams. John Chrysostom, the Patriarch of Constantinople, used his influence to found hospitals, and he urged rich members of the laity to get involved in care for the sick and for the needy. And in addition to providing medical care, the hospitals he founded also provided food for the hungry and cared for the needy in other ways. In Rome, a wealthy noblewoman called Fabiola left her wealth and established and funded a public hospital and got involved herself firsthand in the care of the poor. And then, of course, you've got the foundation of the Benedictine monasteries. Benedict of Nursia founded a monastic order where care for the sick was one of the primary obligations. A free infirmary was opened at the monastery at Monte Cassino, and it was the Benedictines who really imprinted the idea that humility and service are the real marks of greatness. So when you look at the situation before the Islamic conquests of the 7th and 8th centuries, Christian churches could be found across North Africa and the Middle East, and wherever there were Christian churches, there were hospitals as well, which were served by physicians. Some provided convalescent care, some cared for foundlings, some cared for the elderly, some cared for orphans. The Hospital of St. John was founded in Jerusalem in 1099, and it provides a beautiful complex of buildings and help for the poor as well as the sick. And then fast forwarding to Montpellier in 1145, the Hospital of the Holy Spirit was founded, which would become a leading medical centre for training doctors. And by the later Middle Ages, this really is fast forwarding, you could find hospitals right through Western Europe. So if you take England in the later Middle Ages, population of about 4 million people, but there were 600 hospitals, and Italy, France and Germany had even more. The Benedictines continued their monastic tradition of caring for the sick, more than 37,000 Benedictine monasteries caring for the sick. But we need to move now from the Christian ethic of care to the Christian imperative to learn, the foundation of universities. The universities were actually the product of the medieval church, because they began as communities of teachers and scholars centering around the Christian cathedrals. And from the start, the medieval universities were dominated by empiricism. If it was possible to put an intellectual claim to observational tests, then it was believed that should be done. The University of Padua, for example, was founded in 1222. It's the second oldest university in Italy, the fifth oldest in the world. It took a prominent role in the identification and treatment of various ailments. And famously, of course, Padua has the oldest surviving anatomical theatre in Europe. The first modern textbook on surgery was written by a Catholic priest called Guy de Chauliac. He was educated at Montpellier and Bologna, and his seven-volume work, Chirurgia Magna, included more than 3,000 references to other medical works. This key work would be translated into several languages, including French, Dutch, Italian, and Provençal, and it was widely used by physicians across Europe in the later Middle Ages. The father of English medicine is often thought of as Thomas Sydenham. Now, he was a Christian. His Observations on Medicine, 1688, became a standard textbook for a couple of centuries. And famously, his ethic of care centered on what was best for the individual patient, and he insisted on careful observation and accurate diagnosis. You've got to go to the bedside of the patient, he said. There you learn medicine. He used natural resources and natural remedies wherever possible. And famously, during the Great Plague in 1665, he remained in London at great personal risk to treat the sick and the dying. Now, he was motivated by his deep Christian faith. And here's how he summed up his ethic of medical care. He said, "Whoever applies himself to learning medicine should seriously weigh up these following facts. Number one, he will one day have to render an account to the supreme judge for the lives of the sick persons committed to his care. Number two, whatever skill or knowledge he may by the divine favour become possessed of should be devoted above all things to the glory of God and the welfare of the human race. Number three, he should remember that it is no mean or ignoble creature that he deals with. We may ascertain the worth of the human race, since for its sake, God's only begotten Son became man and thereby ennobled the nature that he took upon him. And number four, the physician should bear in mind that he himself is not exempt from the common lot, but is subject to the same laws of mortality and disease as his fellows. He will care for the sick with more diligence and tenderness if he remembers that he himself is their fellow sufferer. But we have to move on. During the 16th century, in those countries that were impacted by the Protestant Reformation, the monasteries were dissolved, and that cut off a source of care for the sick. But in those countries, very often, Protestant clergy continued to demonstrate the Christian ethic of care. And wherever God has moved to revive his church, there has always been an outpouring of ethical fruit, mercy and compassion. And that's certainly the case when we look at the evangelical awakenings of the 18th and 19th centuries. Despite opposition, many, many people, including in the church, even clergy, as well as in the world, were born again and their lives were transformed. And the evangelical awakenings created a whole culture where benevolence, compassion, fellow feeling, sympathy became a social ethic which found practical expression in numerous reform movements and philanthropic enterprises. So, for example, the great revival preacher John Wesley himself took a course in medicine, and he opened a free dispensary in 1746. And then he followed that up in 1747 with writing a book called Practical Physic, or Primitive Physic. And in it, he gathered together the best of available knowledge about various cures, often based on easily accessible resources and remedies. And his great aim was to help poor people help themselves. And this became one of the most popular books published during the 18th century. Also during the 18th century, one of the practical outworkings of religious revival was the founding of a new generation of Christian hospitals, supported mainly by voluntary donations. So in London, these included Westminster, Guy's, St. George's, the Middlesex, and Queen Charlotte hospitals. Also by the 18th century, Edinburgh had become a very internationally renowned medical centre, and it had been deeply influenced by the Presbyterianism, which had emerged from its connections with Calvin's Geneva. For those poor people who couldn't afford hospital treatment, who needed care outside of the hospital system, dispensaries were founded in nearly every town, and these were financed by charitable donations. So typically, churches would preach an annual sermon on the care of the sick, and then they would take up an offering for the local dispensary, which would often provide significant funding for the next year. Edward Jenner is celebrated as the physician who successfully found a safe way of protecting whole populations from smallpox, which of course at one point was the scourge of Europe and beyond. Previously, people had been inoculated with a live smallpox virus, but that could be desperately dangerous and often fatal. Jenner proved that infection could be prevented by inoculating with a milder form, milder disease of cowpox. And initially, he faced enormous ridicule and opposition, but by the time of his death, he was widely honoured. He, however, gave all the glory and honour to God. He said, "I don't wonder that men are grateful to me, but I am surprised that they don't express gratitude to God for making me a medium of good." Another famous Christian doctor, James Young Simpson. He had been horrified by the suffering he witnessed as a young medical student in the operating theatre, and he famously later experimented until he found that chloroform was a safe and successful anaesthetic. And even more famously, he helped Queen Victoria in childbirth using chloroform. But when he was asked to name his greatest discovery, Simpson simply said, "My greatest discovery, when I found that I was a sinner and Jesus Christ was a great saviour." Now, actually, as a reminder that we should never idolise human heroes, we should remember that Simpson could be very proud, very stubborn, and famously, he resisted the important antiseptic theories put forward by Joseph Lister. Now, in many countries, healthcare is now regarded as the obligation of the state, but Christian voluntary contributions laid the foundation. A researcher called James Bartholomew has spent years researching the welfare state in different nations. He documents that before the formation of the National Health Service in Britain in 1948, Britain had one of the leading medical services in the world, but that had been built on the foundation of Christian charitable giving and input. Nursing worldwide has been pioneered by Christian voluntary efforts. Of course, during the early church, widows, deaconesses, other women who committed to celibacy cared for the sick. And of course, during the Middle Ages, monks and nuns cared for the sick. But modern nursing dates back to the pioneering efforts of an order of Lutheran deaconesses at Kaiserswerth in North Germany. And that all began when one pastor, a pastor called Theodor Fleidner, took one poor sick prisoner into his own home and nursed him back to health. And Pastor Fleidner then founded a local hospital and trained poor women as nurses. And his hospital and the professional care given there became famous worldwide. So that by the middle of the 20th century, there were more than 35,000 deaconesses in different countries across the world, serving in parishes, schools, hospitals and prison, providing nursing care. Famously, when the young English aristocrat Florence Nightingale visited Pastor Fleidner at Kaiserswerth, she was so inspired by what she saw there that she defied her aristocratic parents and devoted the rest of her life to nursing. And then, of course, she transformed the vile conditions in the British military hospital in the Crimea during the Crimean War. And then after that, spent the next half century pioneering and publicising modern nursing methods. There's so much that could be said about the Christian contribution, not just to nursing, but to the care of the mentally sick, the Christian contribution to the hospice movement and palliative care, many other fields. But we need to move forward quickly and say something about the Christian mission and healthcare. So worldwide, Christian missionaries have led the way in providing medical clinics, blood banks, mental health programs, as well as drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs. And working in some of the toughest situations on earth, there have been some major medical breakthroughs as a result of medical mission work, such as, for example, the pioneering work of Paul Brand with leprosy patients. A researcher called Robert Woodbury spent many years researching the impact of Christian mission worldwide, and he found that, quote, missionaries typically founded the first hospitals and clinics and pioneered medical education around the world. Informally, missionaries also taught hygiene and rudimentary medical knowledge and introduce new crops and livestock and improve the quality of local diets. He says, thus the historical prevalence of Christian mission is associated with longer life expectancies and lower infant mortality. Christian missionaries have also been at the forefront of providing medical care for women and training female health professionals. I think in one of your previous webinars, you heard about the work of Ida Scudder. And in 1900, she founded or established what would become the Vellore Christian Medical College, designed to train Indian female doctors. And it's said that she brought new hope and dignity to women in South India, giving them the benefits of modern medicine, which had previously been denied them by cultural barriers. She opened up the healthcare profession to women from different faiths and backgrounds, encouraging families to allow their daughters to train as nurses and doctors, and showing by her own example, as well as her students' achievements, that women could equal men both in medical studies and clinical proficiency and excel in leadership, even in the toughest of times. Mahatma Gandhi famously described the Vellore Medical College as the best medical college in Asia. And today it's one of the top ranked educational, healthcare and research institutes in India, with a network of teaching hospitals spread across six campuses. Or we could think of China. Professor Yang writes, the history of Christianity in China can be traced at least back to the 7th century when Nestorian Christians once flourished in the Tang Dynasty. However, the continuous presence of Christianity in China didn't start until 1582 for Catholics and 1807 for Protestants. Today, he says, Christians constitute a growing minority that has made significant contributions in both the expansion of freedom and other social benefits in Chinese societies. Professor Yang says the dynamism and growth of Chinese Christianity bears striking resemblance to the characteristics of faith in the Roman Empire on the eve of the Edict of Milan. Many new converts are professionals, including physicians, and many Chinese believers engage in philanthropic and mercy ministries, including, for some of them, ministries of resisting forced abortion and sterilization and infanticide. Security means that, of course, we can't say much more about the current social impact of believers there, but we can look back at the historical record. So when we first heard of a new virus at the end of 2019, journalists all gathered around Wuhan Central Hospital. One of them took note of the statue in front of the hospital. The founder of the hospital, of course, was the Italian Catholic bishop, Eustachius Zanoli. And then, as medics fought to save lives in the neighboring Wuhan Union Hospital, one of the best in central China, some remember that it had been founded by the Welsh Presbyterian missionary, Griffith John. A few decades before that, in 1835, American Presbyterian missionary Peter Parker had opened Canton Hospital. He had qualified in both medicine and theology before leaving America, but ultimately devoted himself full-time to medical mission. And over two decades, he treated 50,000 patients. And by the end of the 19th century, more than 100 missionary-run hospitals in China had treated millions of patients. Researcher William Huang found that missionaries established the first modern hospitals, medical schools, universities, nurseries, orphanages, and mental asylums across China. And of course, in devoting themselves to both the physical as well as the spiritual needs of others, those Christians were following in a tradition that went right back to the early days of the church. Christianity today is the first truly global religion. For many years, I've used Operation World as a daily prayer guide. And as you go through that, country after country, you see the contribution that Christians are making in so many practical and mercy ministries, often in very difficult situations. And of course, Christian believers are often allowed access to closed countries in order to provide medical care. Access to healthcare in previously inaccessible areas has been facilitated by the work of Missionary Aviation Fellowship. Every 4 minutes, a Missionary Aviation Fellowship plane takes off or lands somewhere in the world to bring both physical relief as well as the good news of the gospel to people made in God's image. And so to wind up, Christians introduced an ethic of life to replace the pagan ethic of death. It introduced an ethic which gives dignity to all human life, because we believe that every human being has been made in the image of God. And since the inception of the Christian church, our medical tradition has combined the best of the tradition of Greek medicine as epitomized in the Hippocratic Oath and the Judeo-Christian ethic of life as laid out in scripture. So John Ling writes in his book, Bioethical Issues, for 2,000 years, two grand pillars have underpinned medical ethics and practice. These two millennia represented the golden age of medicine, where medical care rested on the foundation of respect for life as given by God. But then he outlines how that ethic of care and life has been undermined by a system of utilitarian ethics, where there's an easy progression to the idea that the less fit should be eliminated. And that shift to a culture of death was also documented by the Christian apologist Francis Schaeffer and the physician Everett Koop in their landmark book, Whatever Happened to the Human Race. So right now you're on the front line of medical and dental practice in a culture which for two millennia has respected an ethic of life, but where we are now seeing many threats, including the threats of assisted suicide and euthanasia, threats to move towards a culture of death. Now, I work for the Christian Institute, and we seek to equip the Christian Church with resources to help defend the biblical ethic of the culture of life. And if you want to see our resources, you could go to our website. If you want to sign up for news about further new resources, you could by all means sign up to our free mailing list. But in conclusion, we want to remind ourselves that God has created us as whole people, body and soul. Jesus cared for both. And of course, we should care for both too. In a fallen world, sickness, aging, death will always be there, however we may ameliorate them. But as Christians, we know that the pearl of great price, which can never be taken away from us, is reconciliation with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. And that's why Christians through history have joined a deep compassion for the bodies and minds of their fellow human beings, and also a compassion for their eternal souls. We offer the good news of peace with God. And we know that whatever suffering we and others may be called on to endure in this life, there will be a day when with transformed bodies, glorified bodies, we will serve God forever. So I'm going to conclude this talk with the words of John Wesley. His book, Primitive Physic, concluded with the words, "The love of God is the sovereign remedy of all miseries. By the unspeakable joy and perfect serenity it gives the mind, it becomes the most powerful of all the means of health and long life." Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sharon. You've given us an extraordinary overview of 20 centuries of Christian influence in healthcare and the way the Christian faith, the Christian ethic, and Christ himself have transformed healthcare all over the world. Perhaps, Sharon, I could just start by asking you a little bit more about your book, How Christianity Transformed the World, which I had the privilege of reading even before it was published. And it was really inspiring overview. The chapter on healthcare is just one chapter in it. I wonder if you could just give us a wee overview of some of the other issues that you describe in which Christianity's had a transformational effect on culture.
Well, I begin with the great theme of freedom, Peter. And then I move on to the theme of religious freedom. And I look at the topic of justice. I look at education, the work ethic. So various ways in which, and also there's a chapter on the dignity of women. Many people say that Christianity is bad news for women. The opposite is true. Christianity has been good news for women through history. So it's looking at those various areas. But all the way through, I'm seeking to look at the evidence, which really gives the lie to this current narrative that we're fed, that Christianity is an oppressive and cruel and toxic religion. Of course, there have been some elements of nominal or institutional Christianity that we would never wish to defend. But wherever the true followers of Jesus Christ have been found, there they have wanted to live out that ethic of loving neighbour as well as loving God. And it's that ethic of care that's had an extraordinary impact on society.
Yeah, fascinating. And you mentioned the hostility towards Christianity, and that might surprise some of our listeners in lower or middle income countries. But in the West, there's this sort of narrative that Christianity was bad for culture and destructive of it, and that we've been saved by the product of the secular enlightenment, you know, the age of reason and so on. How has that narrative got about? And what can we say to combat it,
particularly in the so-called Enlightenment in the 18th century, as we look back at it historically, pivoted around certain intellectuals who were wanting to say that human reason can solve our problems. Yeah. And they were wanting to throw out reliance on just taking something by authority, whether that was the authority of clergy or the Bible or God. Now, they then, if you like, spun the story that the important virtues such as justice and truth and care were a product of Enlightenment thinking. Whereas when you really look at the foundation for the ethic of care, it has to be built on that biblical foundation of all human life as equally made in the image of God. That is the only firm foundation there is for, if you like, a strong ethic of respect for human life. The whole modern human rights movement has to rest on that Judeo-Christian ethic of every Christian, every human life being equal in value and worth because made in the image of God. But there's been this, essentially, to make it very simple, Peter, human nature tends to want to do their own thing. And then you have to throw out the idea of God and throw out the idea of judgment. And the so-called Enlightenment thought said we can do without God. There certainly won't be a judgment. Human reason can decide what's right for human beings. But in fact, when you take that logic to the extreme, then you move into a situation where you say, well, which human beings choose what values? If you've got 7 billion people all saying their own, who's to choose between them? And then it's the strongest that win. And then you enter a truly terrifying landscape and scenario. So as Christians, we absolutely hold on to this fundamental ethic. Life is made in the image of God, and that's the foundation for respect for human life.
Yes, and as you say, there wouldn't be a human rights movement at all were it not for Genesis 1:27, because where does dignity of human life come from? It's this whole idea that we're special because we're made in God's image. And I loved your reference to Thomas Sydenham, who's one of my heroes. They call him the English Hippocrates, but saying that human beings are important for two reasons, because they're made in the image of God and because God himself gave nobility to the human race by becoming a human being in the person of Christ. Now, you've created for us a beautiful picture of the preaching and healing going together, really right from the first centuries and the Christians in the Roman Empire. So some Christians today struggle with this. They say, well, you know, if the world's going to be destroyed and Jesus is coming back, then does it really matter about people's bodies at all? Shouldn't we just be concerned about people's souls? What would be your historical and biblical approach to that objection?
That, Peter, is a real undermining of the biblical doctrine of creation. So to have a biblical worldview, we begin with the fact that God created a good world and God has good purposes for his world. And the world is going to be renewed and restored. The new heavens and new earth will be a new heavens and new earth. A real world. And at the cross of Christ, we have in principle the unraveling of all of the effects of the fall, and God is restoring the world. So I think that the sad thing is that some of modern evangelicalism seems to have bought into a mentality that so focuses on individual salvation. And of course we believe in the importance and the priority of each human being repenting and believing and being saved. But the evangelical awakenings, which I've said were a great thing because they produced much ethical fruit and they were a remarkable work of God, they so emphasized the need for a personal relationship with the Lord Jesus that sometimes that was almost removed from the bigger context that we are created by God and we are whole people, body and souls, and we live in whole communities, and God has good designs for the flourishing of humans in communities. And as Christians, he calls us to love our neighbor and to be salt and light. And it's so important to hold together what God holds together, that yes, we care for people's souls, but if we're absolutely ignoring their human suffering, that's not being Christ-like. He cared for both body and soul.
And it was fascinating, and it was certainly new to me when I first read your book, the fact that the great revivalist preacher John Wesley actually effectively wrote a little textbook of medicine and set up seminaries. And that was very much part of his integral approach to mission, wasn't it, back in the 18th century?
It's absolutely extraordinary when you look at it, when you look at the living conditions in the 18th century. For the very poor people, living conditions were very, 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 very dire. And John Wesley took such an interest, famously, in cleanliness. But that wasn't just being picky or fussy. It was actually transforming lives, because it was very much a health measure to be clean. And I took time before this talk to read through Primitive Physic. It's free online. You can just Google it.
Okay.
And of course, there's stuff there that we would smile at, because, you know, they didn't have all of the knowledge that you medics and dentists have now, your extraordinary knowledge. But there's a lot of common sense stuff there. And the motivation why John Wesley took time out of preaching and studying Greek and Hebrew and commentaries to write this was that he cared for the bodies as well as the souls of the people he was ministering to. And he wanted them to live decent lives, and he wanted them to save their children from avoidable diseases that could kill them. And he wanted women to have a better time in labor and to heal up more quickly after labor. And he was just going to put down what the best of knowledge at the time. We wouldn't agree with all of it, but it was the best of available knowledge at the time. And he put it down there, and he put it out there so that people could have happier, healthier lives.
We'll probably put a link to Primitive Physic in the letter that we write to people after this webinar too.
So, it might be on the resource list. I've given
on the resource list already.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, next question here. Do you think the church worldwide has abrogated its responsibility to provide healthcare where state systems are effective? It was fascinating what you described in China, in India, in the UK, and throughout Europe, where these initiatives at hospitals all began with Christians, and then later the state took over. Have we dropped the ball on this?
I don't think it's a question of dropping the ball or abrogating in a culpable way. It's simply that the state has taken over, and that in a sense removes a window of opportunity. However, I would say that in every country where the state takes over, you find Christians moving in to fill the gaps with all sorts of other supplementary ministries. I found it quite extraordinary when researching the chapter on philanthropy to find that during the 20th century in Britain, as many voluntary societies, local enterprises were founded as during the heyday of evangelicalism in the 19th century. Wow. You still get Christians worldwide engaged in very small grassroots local initiatives. But I would point again or mention again the work of this non-Christian journalist, James Bartholomew, because his work on the welfare state we're in, the situation in Britain, and the welfare of nations, the situation internationally, is very sobering, because of course one would argue that in industrial societies, the state, in part of its God-given role to promote good, should provide a safety net. But what he shows is that when you make state provision really big and you remove local input and community involvement, that can result in a diminution of ownership of the care. And he's also, although he's not a Christian himself, very, very warm and commending of the situation pre-welfare state, when it was Christians who were taking the lion's share of the work. Now, it would be too simple to say, let's go back, because as I say, in industrialized societies, we're in a different sort of scale of things now. But there are questions to be asked. That's a good question your listener asked. And I would just simply say, it's not so much that Christians have failed and dropped the ball. It's that state care has extended into the area where Christians used to be. And if you want a thoughtful and intelligent discussion of that, you could refer to those books by James Bartholomew on the resource list.
Thank you. From Kirsty Nordpol here, she says, Sharon, thanks for the stunning overview of Christian faith's influence on healthcare over the centuries. But as a historian, is your impression that this presentation represents widely accepted historical facts? Is this the accepted narrative, or would it be controversial within the current historical profession? Why aren't we hearing more of this from other quarters, really, is what has been asked.
Well, I think that what's interesting, that's an interesting question too. Thank you for that question. It is interesting that in the last 5 years or so, there's been a lot of publicity given to the epic book by Tom Holland called Dominion.
Yes.
And there have been other books along the same lines, not written by Christians, but saying, hang on, for too long, the Christian contribution to history and the good things that have arisen out of that Judeo-Christian worldview have been neglected because there has been this false narrative put out by those Enlightenment thinkers, so-called Enlightenment thinkers that I was talking about, who in their atheistic arrogance wanted to destroy the reputation of Christianity. Now, I go back and say, hands up, there have been elements of our past in the name of Christ that we would not defend. And I would also say, of course, there are cases where non-Christians have provided splendid care because we're all made in the image of God. But the good story that we've had to tell has often been neglected. So in answer to that question, it has often been neglected. And in the current culture wars, Christianity is often painted in the West as the oppressor religion, and it's made into the villain of the piece. So I think that it's time to go back and have a little bit of a review and be willing to tell that positive story.
Well, your talk today certainly helped to dispel some of those notions, and it's really getting the word out. And I hope that people will watch this webinar again and make it available to people. Next question. Today, there are many excellent physicians and great hospitals. To be fair, many are not Christian, and they still provide outstanding care. And despite the issue of medical ethics, say abortion, lots of physicians from other religions and beliefs, for example, Islam, are also against abortion and hold to a culture of life. So the question here is, how do Christians today really show their distinctiveness in healthcare?
Now, that's a good question. And I have tried to lean over backwards to say that we absolutely affirm the truth of God's common grace or everyday grace.
Yes.
Which is why we see splendid, altruistic, caring work done by non-Christians. And we say that whether they acknowledge it or not, it's because they have been made in the image of God. And the God of compassion and care has wired them up to have instincts to do good. And we're grateful for that. So we give God the glory when we see non-Christians serving in splendid ways. Our distinctive belief is that we believe in the resurrection of the dead. At the end of the day, we are all going to die with the best healthcare in the world, the best hospital in the world. All of those people that you are treating will die unless Christ comes back first. But we do not despair in the face of death. So I think in one of your previous webinars, maybe it was you, Peter, highlighted the famous witness of that person who was dying in a hospital in Italy, pointing fellow COVID patients to the truth of resurrection and new life. And so I think that what makes us distinctive is that we absolutely have that overall truth that everyone is made in the image of God, but we also say we are all sinners. We all need salvation. We need to repent and believe and come to Christ. And if we do, we are then assured that we will be raised with Christ to new life in glorified bodies and be able to fulfill our creation purpose, which is to love and serve and enjoy God for all eternity. And that's eternal hope. So it's not just hope for healing in this world. It is hope for, in that sense, eternal healing and new life in the new heavens and the new earth to come.
Yes, thank you for that. And it's a great reminder that although the Christian-inspired healthcare initiative has brought great blessing in terms of long life and good health, it's the resurrection of the body and the new heaven and the new earth that we're really looking to for that. And let's get that into perspective. There's a question here about the Chinese situation. And again, I think what you told us about the development of Chinese hospitals will be new to many people because it's not a history that we're told. Do you think that the Chinese government has created a revisionist history of the origins of healthcare in China? What's your comment on that?
Or perhaps the Western world has?
Yeah.
You know, I can't speak to that because I don't know firsthand, but the two sources that I looked at, both by Chinese people, seem to indicate that that might possibly be the case, because they, as Chinese believers, were trying to, in a sense, redress the balance and say, let's give a shout out to those Christians who did sacrificially lay those foundations. But I did also try to underline the fact that right now it is Chinese national Christians who are in many cases providing splendid health and philanthropic care. And I've been there myself and seen firsthand extraordinary mercy ministries that I could not say more about now for security reasons, but I daily remember that, and I'm humbled by it and by the risks and sacrifice that those Chinese believers were taking to engage in mercy ministries.
Question from Eric Bowler here. You mentioned in your talk that the first church council of Nicaea back in AD 325, it was here that it was stated that all cities which had a cathedral should also have a hospital. And he says he's heard this before. Have we got a source for that statement? Is that in your list of references?
Yeah, that would be in the list of resources. I've given quite a few resources on the PDF resource list that would be put there. So I can't remember whether that would have been David Bentley Taylor or Alvin Schmidt or possibly Vishal Mangalwadi, but there's a list of not just the books, but even the page references for the key sections that you could look at.
Thank you. Well, I'm really sorry, but that's all we've got time for today. We've got many more questions coming through. So it just remains to me to thank all of you, particularly Sharon. Thank you so much for your brilliant talk that you've graced us with. We hope to have you back again sometime in the future. Thank you for your time and your diligence and research and your clarity and presentation as well. I think many people will be really inspired by this today. And thank you all of you for joining us today on ICMDA webinars. May the Lord bless you.